Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Every few times a year, we like to check in with that part of our life where we spend asleep in slumber. It's a third of our life, roughly, but it's so important for the other two-thirds of the time that we are awake. And joining us to do that, Dr. Eric Dykin is with us to help catch up on our sleep news and research, neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Thank you for making time to step over into our studio, Dr. Dykin.
Well, thanks for having us.
We, as usual, we want to check in with some of the latest research on sleep and sleep disorders out there. Have you comment on them as well? But also, we love to reach out to our listeners this hour to have you share your sleep problem, perhaps an unusual sleep experience. Perhaps you have a sleep remedy. Perhaps you didn't sleep well for a long time and, wow, you found something that changed your sleep for the better. We like to hear about all those things. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. If you'd like to email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. And let's jump in with some of the research here. Really interesting here. We've talked before about this in the program. Here's some further research to add a different facet to it. Research published in the journal Brain that poor quality sleep could increase Alzheimer's risk. Describe what we know about poor sleep and Alzheimer's.
Well, as we get older in general, we have less of what they call slow-wave sleep, less deeper, refreshing sleep. So we've always wondered, is that an epiphenomenon of getting older? You get older and you get less slow-wave sleep. And some people believe that if you get slower wave sleep deprivation, you may be at more risk for some of the disorders that the elderly get, like Alzheimer's disease, which in my opinion is the worst neurological disease because you share it with the family.
Mm-hmm. And so talk about, I mean, when it's Alzheimer's disease, we hear talk about the buildup of some proteins in the brain and that link to sleep. So you're saying it's something like not the duration of the sleep, it's the quality of the sleep that perhaps has to do with this buildup in the brain?
Yeah. As we get older, we've noticed the slow-wave sleep, which is the deeper stage of sleep. We call it N3 sleep. We have N1, N2, N3, and then REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep. It's that N3 or slow-wave sleep that tends to be lower in the elderly population, and it may parallel possibly in a cause and effect relationship to disorders like Alzheimer's disease. So if you had more slow-wave sleep when you're older, you might have less Alzheimer's disease, and that's so simplistic. And people suffering from the disorder, they'll be calling in and say, how can I get more slow-wave sleep? And boy, that's an act of God.
Really, you cannot you can't do anything before bedtime in your bedroom or take a drug that gets you into a slow-wave sleep?
Well, that's one of the weaknesses of a lot of the research. It often implies a great avenue for therapy that if you got a relative, which I have a relative, a dad, my father-in-law, he might be listening, and that would be nice. But whatever I could do, I would search for. And I said, well, how do you take the pill to get more slow-wave sleep? Well, there's really no big pill to do that. And you want to avoid medicines when you have an disease like this, undue medicines that may actually have negative effects. So the goal is to try to get you more sleep, more sustained sleep with less arousal. And thus, the research we're talking about, they took older people, and when they went to sleep, they disrupted, as soon as they were going into the brainwave pattern of slow-wave sleep, they disrupted that sleep with a lot of sound. And what did they find? They developed more of the proteins that were associated with Alzheimer's disease, a buildup of this beta amyloid.
Okay. Dr. Eric Dykin is with us, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Join us with your sleep problem, your unusual sleep experience, or perhaps something you found that led to better sleep. We always love to hear the positive side of this sleep research. 1-866-780-9100. 9100. Let's go to Solon. I don't seem to be able to put that person on. I'm going to ask my producer to perhaps put that person on the air if we can, or we'll have to come up with another option. Okay, I think Bill is there from Solon. Is that right?
Yeah, Bill Christensen.
Hi, Bill.
Hey.
So jump in here. Have you got a sleep problem or a remedy?
Yeah, well I went through the sleep studies and worked at the university and ended up getting a CPAP. And it helped a lot with the snoring part, but did a lot of arousal waking, hard to fall asleep. You know, with age, as it comes typically, and waking up multiple times a night, waking up too early.
Mm-hmm.
And so I broke down and finally decided to do a shut-eye program for CBT. And I'm already 2 weeks into it, and I'm already seeing great results.
Now I've actually, just by coincidence, Bill, I've been on this program as well. So describe what it is, because it's a little bit of an online thing. And you're, first of all, you kind of get what your sleep pattern and then the sleep pattern that you'd like to change. You don't want to wake up in the middle of the night. Is that the way I understand it?
Yeah. I want to get that full-on sleep that I can without waking up as much as I can. And get a fixed time waking up in the morning without being groggy, and especially get the afternoon energy. I just crash so much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, been crashing. I still start to struggle through it. But, yeah, basically the general description is just, you know, filling out a diary when you go to sleep again.
Oh, I'm sorry. We lost you there. It dropped off. But fortunately, we know a little bit about shut-eye. Dr. Daikin knows a lot about shut-eye. So the basic thing is you have a sleep diary. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, I mean, and a great lead-in, because Mom and Dad, our administrators at the University of Iowa, all staff is afforded, if you fit the criteria and don't have another major sleep disorder that takes precedence, are offered the shut-eye program, which is CBT, as he quickly said. What does that stand for? Cognitive Behavioral Therapeutic Intervention. And then as we go back to the Alzheimer's disease, there are therapies to improve long-term chronic sleep that might reduce the severity of some of the problems in Alzheimer's disease or just poor sleep across the board from infancy to adulthood. And that includes CBT, cognitive behavioral therapies, which are stimulus control, progressive relaxation therapies, cognitive therapies, the formal terms, but good sleep hygiene, comfortable bedroom, routine bedtimes, awakening times. Bedtime is a time to cool down, watch Rick and Morty, some cartoon, something mindless. Don't do the taxes. Don't turn on the debate and look at the presidential political. Oh, it's time to watch cartoons. And they're better in real life.
Well, one aspect, a concrete aspect of the shut-eye program I know can be, for instance, our caller wanted to get rid of that nighttime wake. You stay awake at the middle of the night. You wake up. You don't know why. You want to go back to sleep. And so shut-eye would kind of say, okay, we're going to, you know, you need to feel good, you need 7 hours of sleep.
Yep.
And so we're not going to let you go to bed until this certain time, and you have to keep yourself awake. That
and
can
what's
be part
that
of
called?
It, too.
What's that called? Sleep restriction. So there's a lot of long, big old Latin terms, but you already know it as some simple things. Don't go to bed early the night you're going to go to Disney World because you're not going to get to sleep. You wait until you're sleepy. That's part of good sleep hygiene. If you go to bed too early, you're going to lay there and you're going to negatively condition.
Okay. Let's go back to some of the research that we're looking at this hour with Dr. Eric Daikin, neurologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, director of its Sleep Disorders Center. We all know the song, Doctor, from a few years ago by Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. Maybe he needs, based on this research, to make a sequel called Don't Sleep, Be Unhappy. We have more evidence suggesting sleep deprivation can take a toll on happiness. In what way?
Well, if you're not sleeping well, you're not thinking well, you don't perform well. You know, we know that in children, their grades aren't going to be – and then it becomes a domino effect on everything else in your life. And if you're a truck driver driving a 40-ton rig and you fall asleep at work, I mean – and that's why we have some of the safest truck drivers in the world. A lot of our research is based upon this. It affects you physically. It affects you mentally. Sleep deprivation is associated with a higher risk of depression. But sometimes you can't tell the difference between – since insomnia, poor sleep is universal in depression, which came first, the chicken or the egg. But if you can improve the sleep, it often improves the depression if you have nothing else solid to improve the depression with. If mom died, it's awfully hard to reverse that. You're still going to be depressed. But if you can improve the sleep around that, you may not perpetuate a lot of the other problems that can linger on for week after week after week. So a positive attitude, this one research talked about just accentuating the positive, and it's easier said than done.
And it's easier when you have a good night's sleep. You can go into the same situation and pick out – that's what this test was about. You pick out positive elements in any situation. You give that same person less sleep, and they will accentuate the negative.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
We have a vocal coach here at the University of Iowa, and you're trying to sing out in front of people, and you think of all the terrible things that she said. Always finish up with what was positive. But there are so many stresses and pressure in the world today, we often don't do that. Always remember there's something positive. And at the end of the day, it's my kids with all their Adult Swim comics and oh, have you seen Guardians of the Angel 2?
Not the latest one.
Oh,
no,
great.
Okay, let's go back to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Talk with Dr. Dykin, share your sleep problem, your sleep remedy, your strange sleep experience. Those are all welcome this hour. Zach is with us in Keosauqua. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure, you're loud and clear. Go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Awesome. Thanks. So I had not been sleeping very well the past few weeks until I got involved with some political organizing. And I've been doing a lot of walking, exercising, you know, walking around, knocking on people's doors and talking to them about stuff. And so I've noticed that after a lot of this increased exercise, I've been sleeping really well. And I was curious, you know, if there's any research on the relationship between exercise and sleep quality.
Interesting. So maybe it's not the politics that's getting you better sleep. Maybe that is, too. Maybe you're an effective
catharsis.
No, it's not.
It's not the politics. It's the exercise. What about the exercise, Dr. Dykin?
Well, going back to Alzheimer's, what can you do to improve your more refreshing stages of sleep? Well, one of the things is to be active during the day, to really need the restoration that sleep provides. So getting outside in the sun, that will often depress the sleepiness during the day and help the sleepiness that you want at night. And the exercise, we know that low-level exercise, and for somebody with bilateral hip replacements, walking is my best exercise. It increases your core body temperature, and that may parallel an increase in that slow wave or deep refreshing sleep that elderly often have. So in some retirement communities, they get outside at midday, they exercise, they walk. That's when you really get the core temperature up, and it might have a parallel increase in slow-wave sleep at night, not just for old people like you and me, but for young people like Zach.
All right. Zach, very good. Canvassing as a way, political canvassing as a way to help your sleep problems. That's the first on the show, Zach. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Join our conversation with your sleep problem or experience, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Danny. Danny is in Des Moines. Hi, Danny. Danny, are you there? Danny is not there. Let's go to Tim. Tim in Ames is there. I hope we're not running into a series of technical problems. Tim, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. You can hear me. I can hear you. Welcome to the program.
Good, thank you. Yeah, I have a question for Dr. Dykin. I've been reading about recent research on the relationship between the flashing 40 hertz light and stimulation of gamma waves in the brain and the subsequent clearing of these beta amyloids. I just wonder if you can comment on the relationship between gamma activity and slow wave sleep.
Well, actually, there's a fast activity. There are all sorts of wave that they call on an EEG. There's alpha waveforms, there's delta waveforms, there's slow waveforms, which is 1 to 2 cycles per second. And there's also waveforms associated with light, you know, which is a vibration element too. There's blue light that we often use when we're using bright light therapy to reduce sleepiness during the day. So sometimes you can trip upon yourself, I often do, with the different gammas and the thetas, etc. But what we do sometimes for therapy, as we've alluded to, let's go back to the Alzheimer's again. I'd like to make sure we know that there are ways to treat some of the sleep-related problems in Alzheimer's, but it's not a magic pill. Sometimes it's as simple as keeping up during the day and doing the walking that Zach talked about during the bright light of the early morning or late morning or early afternoon, which is about 50,000 lux, which is a level of illuminance, as you said, you know, a frequency discharge, which will reduce, we've all heard of melatonin, the melatonin release that usually occurs at night when it gets dark. So it keeps you more awake, as will that exercise. You're walking. You're not going to fall asleep while walking, although I've almost done that on occasion because of the job. We work at night, but good exercise during the day and the use of bright light will reduce the melatonin during the day, and then it will increase because the core body temperature effect, the slow wave sleeps at night, which is 2 cycles per second. But, and again, that's a way to bring together some of the frequencies, but you can get lost with the gammas, the deltas, the alphas. But, you know, but it is pretty cool.
Okay, Tim, thank you for your call from Ames. You're talking about the good sleep related to getting out in the sunshine. Here's a perfect anecdote for this week that you're on. Of course, Ragbri is currently going on. They're in their, what is this, their second day of riding, still out in the western part of the state. I think Algona is the overnight night tonight. But I've been on Ragbri a number of years, and I've noticed that in Ragbri, because you stay up late, you want to see all the goings-on, you want to participate in the parties at the host towns at night, and you get up very early to get your biking in before it gets hot, that really, I said, I'm only getting five and a half hours of sleep. I feel great, though. Well, the whole day you're out in the sunshine biking through the Iowa countryside. So that makes sense.
Well, what is sleep for? We know sleep deprivation in animals, it will kill them. There's something restorative. So you're out all day. And then, as you said earlier, the research shows a positive attitude. You want to be out there. You're exercising. You're happy. And that exercise is going to really fatigue you. You're out in the sun. Your N3 slow wave sleep is going to be anybody 60 and over, I would go out there with Ragbri if you got 2 good hips and be careful out there. But I bet you it's going to be good for sleep.
1-866-780-9100. Let's go back to our phones as we discuss good sleep, bad sleep. I guess ugly sleep, good, bad, and the ugly. It's all there when we talk about sleep disorders. Audrey is with us from Mason City. Hi, Audrey.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Hey,
welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I guess so. My question is, I actually have kind of 3 questions. So the first one is, when we're talking about the amount of sleep, I heard you reference 7 hours. What level of sleep is that 7 hours at? Is that 7 hours just the overall process? Or is that like 7 hours of like the deep sleep? I wear a smartwatch at night, and I know it's not super accurate, but this bad boy's telling me I'm getting like 3 hours of deep, uninterrupted sleep.
Now, it should be, and this is the bell-shaped curve, and there are us that lies at the feet of the bell-shaped curve. But for most people, adults, they need 7 to 9 hours of sleep on the bell-shaped curve. And that was a study they alluded to just a few years ago. But grandma said that forever. But that's most people, but that's total sleep time. So that it usually takes us a few minutes to get to sleep, a few minutes to wake up. It's normal to have a few arousals at night. But we're really talking about total sleep time. 25%, 20% of your sleep may be the REM sleep, you know, was it around 20%+, maybe 15% the slow wave sleep. But as we get older, we get less and less of the slow wave sleep. But there are some of the things we've talked about you can work with, good sleep hygiene, exercising during the day, increasing your core body temperature.
Well, Audrey is using some smartwatch there that must, I guess, Audrey, it measures how restless you are in the night, and that's how it tells you what the next day, that really only 3 hours was where you were just zonked out. Is that what you read from it?
Yeah, based off what it's doing is it's monitoring my heart rate and then also movement.
Mm. So you have a little sleep study going on there every night.
Yes. And then my other two questions was, when we're talking about exercise, I've always heard that you shouldn't exercise like in the evenings because that can affect your sleep. I'm a runner, and sometimes I don't make it out for my run in the morning. Am I okay to go ahead and run when I get off of work at like 7, 8 o'clock at night? And then what correlation does exercise or does your sleep have in reference to weight loss?
Well, and a couple things there, and we know that exercise, and sometimes you have to be an experiment within yourself. They usually recommend you finish your exercise 4 to 5 hours before going to sleep. If you've ever run a marathon, try to do that and then take a nap. You're gonna get muscle cramps. It's not going to be that easy. You'll sleep well in the evening, but usually 4 to 5 hours before. But a lot of runners, always would run in the morning. Got it out of the way psychologically, but there's the psychosocial element of that too. So again, around 4 to 5 hours for most people. Now, weight loss and sleep in general, there's a lot of psychosocial with that. And it depends on what degree of weight loss. And we know that for morbid obesity, people who are very, very heavy, and that's actually a term that is sort of negative, if you will, but oftentimes it's going to be the banding procedures, the diet. If you've ever had a weight problem, it's easier said than done. But when you're going through that fasting period, which some people do with ketosis, it's really hard to sleep when you're hungry. So insomnia is not an unusual accompaniment with people who are already trying to lose weight, already under stress, and this is where things like cognitive behavioral therapy come in, and imaging and sleep restrictions can be helpful because when you're hungry, a well-placed snack, sometimes even on a diet, is very helpful because it's difficult to fall asleep when you're starving.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Audrey, thanks for that question. Keep up your running, and hopefully your good sleep, Audrey. Let me just ask you this hypothetical. What if you had to stop running? What would happen to your sleep, you think?
I honestly don't. I'm not 100% sure. I think my sleep is more affected by my dog than my activity level, to be honest.
There's a whole other topic there. Pets and sleep. We've talked about that before on this program, too. Okay, Audrey.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
We're wishing you good sleep. Thanks, Audrey, for calling from Mason City. We're going to take a short break and be back with Dr. Eric Dykin, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. When we come back, a study from Stanford talking about the risk for suicide connection with bad sleep. Also, don't argue when you're sleep deprived, not only because it turns into a really bad argument with your spouse or your partner, but also because it's physiologically harmful to you. We'll tell you about that study when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer with Dr. Eric Dykin, news, sleep, and research show this hour. Back in just a few minutes.
I'm so tired. My mind is set on you. I wonder, should I call you? But I know what you would do.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to focus on political strife and turmoil. For a change, it'll be outside of the U.S.'s borders. We're going to be looking at the two countries in South America where there's a lot going on politically and economic crises in Brazil and Venezuela tomorrow on this program. Also, a tornado ripped through the town of McGregor in the eastern part of the state just last week. No fatalities, no injuries. We're going to check in with McGregor to see how much damage and how the cleanup and recovery is going tomorrow on this program. Today, we're catching up on our sleep news and research with Dr. Eric Dykin of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center, and we're inviting you to share your sleep problem or your sleep remedy or your unusual sleep experience. 1-866-780-9100, and let's go right back to the phones. Let's go to, I guess I have clicked on Fairfield. Is it Teresa?
Yes, that's right, Teresa.
Hi, Teresa in Fairfield. You got a sleep problem to share with us?
I do. I have a young teenager who sleeps for 8 to 16 hours at a stretch, and then he stays awake for like 30, 35 hours at a stretch.
Eight to 16. He can sleep 16 hours, 8 to 16 hours in a stretch, and then he's just up for...
Yeah, but almost a couple of days, like a day and a half or so, he'll be awake.
Hmm. Is he? What is he doing when he is awake? Is he, well, being a teenager,
he's a pretty healthy guy.
Yeah.
He's physically active. He does very well academically. He's a really nice person.
Yeah.
But he has this bizarre sleep schedule. Is it something that I should be worried about?
Well, one of the thoughts is, if there's no complaint, if there's no obvious problem, and you and I have to sleep sometimes too. And so what's really going on? You really don't know. And we've talked about some of that. Why do we have some of those Fitbits, these movement monitors, sleep monitors that many of our call-in people have actually used? We call it actigraphy, because sometimes you really don't know who's asleep on their feet or napping at one time or having the power nap, but you know, behind your back. So it's hard to tell, but if there's no problems, I would back off. if first, do no harm. My son, he's taking the MCATs coming up. He wants to be a neurosurgeon. That's pretty cool, but a lot of stress and pressure, but he is sleep phase delayed normally. So he's a young adult. He's 22 years old, and he tends to stay up very late at night, you know, 1 to 2 in the morning, that's his normal, and he sleeps in late during the day. That's relatively normal for that age group. And in fact, my wife had helped with changing the Iowa City High School, junior high school times, so they're a little bit later, and the students, the older students, adapt better and do better academically, socially, with a different time frame. So you never really know what your kids are doing 100%, but if they're doing well, they often know what they're doing. Leave them alone. But we do know if he's depressed, and this is something we're going to talk about a little bit later this hour, the variability in bedtime, awakening times, often parallels obvious clinical depression. And that is something you would like to correct with the cognitive behavioral therapy that we've talked about. But your son is probably doing better than you and I think. And until he comes and complaining, I would first do no harm and just watch him carefully like a good loving parent always does.
Teresa, thank you.
Thank you.
Sounds like a good idea, Teresa in Fairfield. Let's talk about what you just referenced there. We want to talk about briefly about a study from Stanford published in June in the journal Clinical Psychiatry, finding that among young adults at risk for suicide, highly variable sleep patterns may predict an increase in suicidal symptoms, and this is independent of depression. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and this was not her son. This is a group of kids that were selected for high suicide risk. Of 5,000 kids, they looked at 18 to 22-year-old, very high risk for suicide, and they found that the highest correlate with suicidal ideation was associated with variable bedtime and awakening times, especially the bedtime, hour-to-hour difference.
So things don't stay the same day-to-day. They get switched up. You sleep 5 hours, then you sleep 2 hours, then you're awake. Yeah. So it's just all over the map.
Yeah. Even with our last caller, he had a set of what he did. There was a habit. There was an expectation, a routine, if you will. Oftentimes, day to day, you don't know how you feel, what you're going to do. It often parallels that poor sleep hygiene.
Okay, let's go back to our phones. Wade is with us in Creston. Hi, Wade. Thanks for calling.
Hi, gentlemen.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
Well, thank you.
To you. I feel like taking a nap now. Oh, I'm joking.
Is that positive?
The problem I have is evening time. Typically wake up, I'll be G-rated here, but I have to go to the bathroom. Say, you can almost set your clock by, I'd say around 3:30, almost 4 o'clock perhaps, different nights. But then it's getting back to sleep after that. after waking up and having to use the bathroom. And then, but my mind usually goes into a whirlwind of thoughts, and they're always good thoughts. It's just kind of reflecting on the day or reflecting on the day to come. But it's just getting past those, you know, that thinking portion of the evening. Say, that's enough. You just have to convince yourself, no more. So I guess that's all I've used, but if you have any additional tips that might be helpful there. I really have to kind of talk myself into saying, that's enough, no more thinking.
Don't think about the elephant. Well, yeah, don't think about this or that. That's a hard thing to do, Wade. So any techniques that Wade could practice there, Dr. Daikin?
Well, even as we've implied with the cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, the imagery, you know, a positive imagery, you know, I'll tell you, counting sheep, it just drives me crazy. But, you know, something you can return to, not thinking about, like you said, your mind goes all over the place. But I'll often have a routine thought. I used to love to go camping with the kids, but I think about being out with the rains coming down just a little bit. We're out in the middle of the woods, and we're all protected, and the dog's with us. You know, that kind of a recurrent thought, a positive imagery. And we know that from the other research we've talked about today. If there's a negative thought or a wrong thought going, oh, yeah, what was – now, we got the taxes coming up. And it may not be that negative of a thought, but you perturbate. You think about it, and you can't get back to sleep. Nevertheless, you did wake up with the need to use the bathroom. And the first thing I would do, even in that, because I have a bias, sleep apnea is so common. One in every five American adult has it. And low oxygen is not a good thing for you. So sleep apnea, floppy throat, your airway closes off. You get low oxygen, your heart, your brain, and your eye. And it can be detrimental over a long-term period. People with nocturia often have a higher risk of having sleep apnea because your chest expands, it stretches the heart, and this thing called atrial natriuretic factor comes out, and you pee at night. But if you drink a lot of water late at night, you may have to wake up to go to the bathroom. If you have diabetes, you may need to wake up to go to the bathroom. If you have urinary tract infection, I mean, blah, 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 blah. There's a lot of reasons you can wake up to need to use to go to the bathroom and then have difficulty falling to sleep. But I would also then ask, if I was your primary care physician, your nurse, your PA, your MA, the whole history and examination, get under the hood, other than, again, be careful when you're getting medical advice from some guy on the radio or some gal on the radio. Superficially, now I'm going to already have you go see your doctor for sleep apnea. So one of my thoughts, have positive thoughts. But if you snoring like a banshee, waking up gasping, and if you got kissing tonsils, maybe talk to your PA, MA, and make sure you don't have sleep apnea.
Okay. Hey, Wade, one other thing here, if you've got racing thoughts, would it sound like you did too? We've had other people call up and have success, and I don't know if your bedroom allows this, but if your thoughts, you can't get off the next day or some kind of concerns that you have, some people have success by listening to audiobooks so that you get into a narrative that is not your own life, and it's, you know, it's not your worry, so you can kind of enjoy the story because you have no dog in that fight, really, and then it kind of gets you away from your own problems. I've heard that work for people.
It's ironic, and if I didn't obviously share the bedroom with my wife, one of the things that I've often done is listen to talk radio. I mean, if I'm able to take an afternoon nap.
Especially Ben Kiefer. Yeah.
Yeah. When I get that future late night show, we can tune in, Wade.
Well, you know, we have talked about other audio wavelengths that Phyllis Z from Northwestern is using as background white noise, brown noise. We've talked about the ocean rushing. What works for an individual, as you've implied, works for the individual. So a lot of different things are out there.
Good luck, Wade, from Creston.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. All right. Let's get to another caller. Let's go to Kara. Kara has been waiting in Waterloo. Hi, Kara. Kara, are you there? Kara, not there. Barbara in Bettendorf, are you there?
Yes.
Great. Oh, wonderful. We're running out of time, so what would you like to talk about here with sleep?
Well, many things, but one question is, as I understand it, it's okay to have like a glass of wine with dinner and maybe another small glass, like 4 or 5 ounces, something like that.
Oh, so there's a good one.
Does that affect
alcohol
your sleep?
Before bedtime. That's a no-no, doctor. I know that.
Well, not before bedtime.
Okay.
Earlier than that.
All right. Okay.
Well, it depends. And, you know, for cholesterol, they tell me 2 4-ounce glasses of wine with dinner is supposed to be good to lower the cholesterol, and why the French and blah, blah, blah have lower cholesterols, etc. Psychosocially, It's very healthy for some elderly people, depending, something they enjoy. I mean, but too much of a good thing can be, and that's what Ben is talking about. With people with known obstructive sleep apnea, any kind of central nervous system sedative, which alcohol is the biggest, a 1 ounce shot of whiskey, 4 ounce glass of wine, or a 12 ounce beer, if you take two of those, it can make mild apnea much worse. This is why Prince, Michael Jackson, a lot of the Heath Ledger, they took sedatives that got them to sleep but also stopped their breathing. So I have sleep apnea. I'm much more sensitive to central nervous system sedatives, including that glass of wine. So, and many people, talk to your PA, your MA, your ARNP, your MD, the doctor that knows you the best, the backbone of medicine, your primary care people, and make sure that it is okay for you. Because if it's 2 glasses, 4 ounce glass of wine with dinner, well, good for you.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
All right.
Thank you.
Good luck and good sleep to you, Barbara at Bettendorf. Let's go back to a little bit of the research we've had in the last few weeks that we like to look at periodically when we have you on, Dr. Dyke. And this is interesting. Some research that deals with evolution and perhaps why older people, as we get older, we develop, many of us develop a sort of insomnia. We hear about it every time we do a sleep show. A recently published study find that humans' age-specific sleep patterns may have evolved to protect mixed age groups from potential danger at night. This is a study conducted among a certain hunter-gatherer group in Tanzania called the Hazda. They traditionally sleep outside. So you looked at this study. So this is really the thought here is that evolution would say we need people to be watchmen. So we'll just, as they grow up and get older, we'll just make their night sleep pattern a little screwy so they get up and watch for the rest of us.
Yeah, it was interesting. When they look at the whole group from young adult to elderly, they said at any given time, a full 40% of the population was awake, at least a little bit awake. There were only 18 one-minute intervals where everybody was asleep. I mean, so at some time, people got rest, but the people who had the most arousals and the least amount of rest were the elderly that were essentially, we're talking about older people over age 50, older 60, and we're trying to improve sleep and Alzheimer's, maybe to improve quality of life. So paradoxically, what they're thinking, this sentinel hypothesis, and then kowtowing to grandmother, it used to be called the grandmother hypothesis, but then to be equal rights, we got the grandparent hypothesis. When we get over the age of 60, which I did a while back, no, it's not unusual to have these less slow wave sleep, more frequent arousals. And what they actually said that there's always somebody with one eye open waiting at the front gate in case the marauding hordes came over the hill. So what was it? Beverly Hillbillies, granny in the front yard with a shotgun. I mean, you take that out a little bit. It's sort of cute. But they honestly believe there may be some survival advantage so that the younger people, the younger women, the younger men get their sleep so they can work harder and do all the plowing, have the babies. But there's a reason for mom and me to still be alive with these grandkids. We take care of them. They teach you survival, where the young kids go out and make sure we get fed.
All right. Another bit of research, Dr. Dyken, before we end this hour. We all know the time to get into an argument with a spouse, with a partner, is not when the two of you have had a crummy night's sleep. A new study, though, pointing to a genuine health benefit of avoiding such touchy times to get into arguments when both people in the partnership are sleep deprived. So these are researchers from Ohio State University Institute for Behavioral Medicine Research. So actually, besides having a crummy outcome likely for an argument, you're doing physiologically some damage?
Yeah, when you're under stress, for example, we've all heard being scared to death. Well, that's a possibility. The sympathetic, autonomic, get-up-and-go nervous system is firing. Your blood pressure, your heart rate, everything's up. And parallel with that are these blood markers, inflammatory markers that can do damage to blood vessels, to the heart, make you more predisposed to heart disease, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So physiologically, being scared to death, it really is trying to be under stress and pressure and having a bad argument. And they looked at these couples and they said if they could at least get one of them to get at least 7 or more hours of sleep, true total sleep time that the scientists have shown in the bell-shaped curve what most adults need. If you or your spouse can get the better sleep, oftentimes you're under a little bit more control, then you have less blood inflammatory markers elevated after you engage in a conversation on a topic known to induce stress in the two of you. So they look at the blood markers before and after your little conversation, and if you had good sleep, it was reduced. Second thing, if you learn to speak cordially and compassionately and in a caring fashion with your spouse, you also had lower. So two ways to do it. One, if you get good sleep, two would be better. Learn how to speak to someone you love.
Okay. Another reason, yet another reason to be civil in whatever situation you're in. Rebecca in Des Moines is with us. She'll be our last caller. Rebecca, not much time, but what's on your mind?
I have idiopathic hypersomnia. Is there any new research that would give me an option besides just taking a stimulant for treatment?
Okay, Rebecca, I'm going to ask the doctor, what is idiopathic hypersomnia?
So idiopathic hypersomnia, a simple way of saying it is you're born needing more sleep than most of us. There's a bell-shaped curve that we've talked about. 7 is what you need. Idiopathic, routinely, they need 10 or more hours to be refreshed for physiologic refreshment. What's not fair about idiopathic, you more sleep you get, like take a nap, it's often the reverse. You take a nap during the day, it's sleep inertia, you feel even worse.
Rebecca, does that describe you in some way?
Yes, I have the irresistible urge. My body will just shut down itself to take a nap. But I don't have narcolepsy. I've had the sleep study
right.
and all that.
So how
but,
how much?
Yeah, do you... I don't ever feel refreshed when I wake up from any nap or any sleep.
How many hours would you say you're in bed sleeping or some
9
hours per day? That's
yes.
not that's
well plus a nap in the afternoon.
Plus a nap. Okay, so
she's getting over the 10, 24 hour. And so one of the things, and you know what works for you probably already, and you're an expert on yourself, so I'm sort of talking down to you, but judicious use of the stimulants is really helpful, especially around the time of work. If you could work with that nap and the sleep restriction, some people have found that the nap is counterproductive. You just feel crummier, and you feel worse than when you went to sleep. But as you've implied, narcolepsy is easier to get better symptomatic improvement with the medications. Idiopathic hypersomnia, it's not fair in our society to need 10 or more hours of sleep because we're a 24-hour per day, and it really hurts your competitive nature in this very aggressive competitive world. But if you can get an island and you can live in paradise that we all dream about, it would be a much better world for you. But again, I am empathetic. Work with the nap or without the nap, and then follow the best stimulants that are out there on the market under the knowing guidance of a good healthcare professional that's following with you, because they're going to know you better than anybody else.
Thanks, Rebecca, in Des Moines.
Thank you.
Wishing you good sleep. So explain that to us. Rebecca mentioned Ritalin, which is a stimulant.
Yeah.
why do you give Ritalin to people? So in her case, you want to wake her up more of the day. So it's similar to the way you'd use caffeine?
Well, not really, but in some regard. There are many areas throughout the brain, and we talk about the get-up-and-go system that we all learned about in junior high where you're in a room with a lion and your heart rate picks up. Your body has an area of the brain in the brainstem and also in the cortex, the big part, multiple areas where things are released that medicines can take advantage of. The Ritalins, the amphetamine-like drugs take advantage of your endogenous, the dopamine and epinephrine that's already in your system, whereas caffeine works on a little bit different system. But they're really playing off Mother Nature and making the most of what Mother Nature is producing with the parallel of that medication. But the medications can sometimes have side effect, your blood pressure, your heart rate, your behavior. So nothing – I mean, you can drink too much water and get low sodium, and it could be bad for you. So most of our patients don't want to have to take medicines. But for idiopathic hypersomnia, they need 10 to 12 hours of sleep per night. How is my daughter going to be president of the United States if she's sleeping 12 hours a night? And it's just not fair. And it is a tough disorder. And this is why people are doing research. That lady has a tough disorder and needs compassion and may have to think about what job is going to be best for me when I'm sleeping all the time. You need a good support group.
Okay. Dr. Eric Daikin, we've run out of time for this hour, catching up on our sleep news and research and also answering questions of as many as we could of the listeners who called in. Thank you so much for sharing your sleep questions and problems with Dr. Daikin. And we had a remedy or two there, too, this positive side of it. Neurologist and director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Dr. Eric Daikin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
River to River, produced by Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Today, going out with a little sleep music on this special program. Tomorrow on our program, I hope you'll join us once again. I'm Ben Kiefer.